Welcome. Who's talking? This is D.G. Martin. Well, David Silkenhead is a Duke grad, but he's got his Ph.D. from Chapel Hill in history.
Yeah, I try to be quiet during basketball season.
And if you talk around the history department at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, they're very proud of this graduate of their program. David Silkenhead is now affiliated with the University of Edinburgh, and he's a senior lecturer in American history. In a brand new book, he talks about a new way to look at the Civil War through the eyes of, I guess, the white flag. David, is that,
yeah,
that the surrender? What was the role of surrender? What was the protocol? What were the consequences? And how did people view the act of surrender, either by a fort or by a large military unit, or on the battlefield by a single soldier. So, David, welcome.
Oh, thank you very much. Yes, it's good to be back. It's very good to be back in Chapel
Hill. Why did you have to go to Scotland to write a book about the American Civil War?
Well, I've been very lucky to be able to teach at the University of Edinburgh for the past 6 years. And it's a wonderful city to live in, and they're very deeply interested in American history. You know, it does give me plenty of good opportunities to come back to Chapel Hill, though, to do research. The Civil War, though, isn't all that far away in Edinburgh. We've got a monument to the American Civil War about a 15-minute walk from my office. So, even though the war is 4,000 miles away, in some ways it's a global conflict.
Well, the British Isles, I'm not sure about Scotland, but there was more sympathy for the Southern cause than you would have expected from a progressive country.
Yeah, well, the Britain had very mixed feelings about the Civil War on all kinds of levels. The relationship between the United States and the UK in the mid-19th century was a very complex one, and there were pockets of the UK that were very sympathetic to the Confederacy, and there were pockets that were very active supporters of the Union, and part of that depends on, you know, the role of shipping, the role of the cotton trade and textiles, but also there's a very robust abolitionist movement in the UK that,
they'd gone through this.
They saw themselves by the mid 19th century as the great abolitionist force in the world, and so at various different points in the war, the British public sentiment changes. So it's a complex story about the relationship between the UK and
a subject of another book, maybe.
Well, yes, there's actually a number of books people have tried to tackle that problem. So it's
ironically, your book on surrender, sort of the concluding surrender in the Civil War, didn't take place at Bennett Place or at Appomattox or out someplace in Texas. It took place where?
In Liverpool, in the UK. There's actually a variety of competing places for where the Civil War ends, but the story of the CSS Shenandoah is one of my favorite. It's a commerce raider that's purchased by the Confederacy. It's manufactured in the UK, but it's used for attacking American shipping and whaling vessels. They end up near the Arctic Circle around Alaska, attacking whaling vessels. And they attack ships, and they're told in 1865 that the war is over. And initially, they don't believe it until they find a newspaper that says that the war had ended months previous. And then they realize they're in trouble because they had a document saying they were allowed to do this under the laws of war when the Confederacy existed. But now the Confederacy had been destroyed, that they were worried that they'd be prosecuted for piracy. And so then they decide it'd be safer to surrender to the British than it would be to the Americans. So then they sail back around the world to Liverpool to surrender there because they thought they'd get better treatment. Which I guess they may have done, but it's a very interesting and odd way for the war to end.
Well, your book is about surrender, and I assume this is kind of a new way to look at the Civil War, or are you just following in the footsteps of other historians?
Well, there's the basic central premise of the book, the revelation that sort of led me to write it, was this idea that they do surrender an enormous amount during the Civil War. The way in which most people consider the war starts at Fort Sumter with a surrender. It ends with these series of surrender at Appomattox Courthouse and Bennett Place. And, in between, many of the major decisive moments of the war are surrenders at Fort Donelson, at Harper's Ferry, at Vicksburg. And what I quickly discovered is that, in fact, those are just the tip of the iceberg. There are dozens of more surrenders. And so what I wanted to do in the book is try to figure out why this had happened. One of the things I was worried about when I sort of came upon this project, as I said to myself, somebody has to have written this book before. That's sort of the great peril when you start writing a book, is you worry you'll get about a third of the way into it, and then you'll say, "Oh, somebody's
it's
already
been covered."
This has already been done before by somebody much smarter than I am. But what I realized is that that story hadn't been told in the way that I was doing it. People had obviously told the story of Fort Sumter and Vicksburg and Appomattox Courthouse and Bennett Place. All those stories had been told individually, but trying to put it together from the beginning to the end and try to make sense of the ways in which the Civil War generation understood surrender and the ways in which, they made sense of what it meant to raise the white flag, to lay down your arms, to choose not to fight. In the midst of this extraordinarily bloody war, no one had really posed that particular set of questions before. And so I am building on a tremendous amount of scholarship. In many ways, this book was easy to find materials for because so many of these individual episodes had been so very deeply researched. It wasn't hard to track down accounts of Fort Sumter or Appomattox or Vicksburg or what have you. But connecting the dots was, I think, the thing that no one had done before.
Well, Fort Sumter is that's a great start for your book because it involves an exchange of – at least an exchange of artillery or at least some artillery falling on it.
No, there's tons and tons of artillery falling on it, yeah.
And resistance. So there's a – not just a choice to surrender as might have been. But why do you start with Fort Sumter?
Well, I start with Fort Sumter in some way because that's the surrender at the beginning of the war that most people know, right? And I imagine everyone listening to this has heard the story of Fort Sumter before, but this is the fort that's in the middle of Charleston Harbor. It's garrisoned by Robert Anderson in a very small garrison. And a crisis emerged when South Carolina secedes from the Union in December of 1860, and a crisis that lasts from that point through the end of the Buchanan administration into the Lincoln administration. And Confederates in April 1861 demand that Anderson surrender the fort. He refuses. They fire upon the fort for 34 hours. And at this point, they've got batteries pointing at it at the fort from multiple directions. And after 34 hours with the fort on fire, Anderson surrenders. In some ways, that's a story everybody knows, but I wanted to sort of situate that story as establishing kind of what the rules were for when one could and one couldn't surrender. And what people often don't know about Fort Sumter is that, Anderson and his garrison, when they leave, when the surrender happens, they are allowed to leave by Confederates, and they go up to New York City. They travel on a Navy vessel. And they are greeted as heroes. There's an enormous parade for them in the middle of New York City. The New York Times says the entire population of the city showed up to greet them. There's a whole series of speeches that praise them for their conduct at Fort Sumter. And that really becomes the template for the entire war for both armies about when you could surrender, when you've if somebody has demanded your surrender and you've refused and you fought to the point where you realize that continuing to fight is only going to cost you the lives of your men, then both Union and Confederate armies thought that was a legitimate time to raise the white flag, that there was nothing dishonorable about doing that. In fact, Anderson gets a promotion and he's greeted like a victorious general in many ways. And I think it says something about the ways in which the Civil War generation saw surrender in a very different way than modern Americans do. One of the things I realized very early on in the process was that the language they used to talk about surrender was very different than Americans in the 20th or 21st century. I'm thinking about President Kennedy during the Cuban Missile Crisis. He has this famous address on live television, and he says there's one path that Americans will never choose, and that is the path of surrender. And you find versions of that claim that Americans never surrender, uttered by pretty much every American politician of the late 20th century. So Nixon, Reagan, both Bushes, McCain, Obama, the current president. You know, men who don't agree on much of anything else, they seem to all agree that Americans never surrender. But here in the Civil War, people were surrendering all the time. And so trying to make sense of the frameworks, the rules, and the language they used was one of the sort of main objectives in writing the book.
If you joined us late, we're talking about the Civil War and surrender in the Civil War, talking with David Silkenhat. He and I will be right back after this short break. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. If you joined us late, my guest is David Silkenhat. He is senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh. He got his undergraduate degree at Duke and his Ph.D. In history from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. So welcome back.
Thank you.
We were talking about your book on surrender during the Civil War, and I guess if you ask anybody what the major surrender was, we would probably say Fort Sumter. I mean, there'd be many others, and
the Appomattox Courthouse in Vicksburg, right? Yeah, those are the big ones people think of.
Those, yeah, of course. One of the things that your book introduced me to, the notion, and I'm not sure where how far I can go with it, was that there was more to the Fort Sumter tactics or strategy at the Union level than just holding out until they were overcome. That part of it was that it was important that the North was not viewed as the aggressor, that we wanted to get the shells fired at Fort Sumter so Lincoln could say, I didn't start this war.
Well, I think, you know, one of the interesting things about the Civil War is it is a war between two democracies, and in a democracy you have to sort of marshal not only military power, but you have to marshal the political will and the moral will to fight a war, and having somebody else fire first at you is one of the ways to do that. And so, you know, the Lincoln administration throughout the crisis is eager not to give up the fort without putting up a fight, because that would signal weakness and other kinds of things to the northern populace. But they also didn't want to be the ones to fire first. And so there are debates about, okay, if the garrison is running out of food, how do we resupply them with food? How do we do that without putting people in jeopardy? There are various schemes about how they're going to do that. And obviously Lincoln at the end of the crisis, you know, says he's going to send reinforcements to Fort Sumter and signals to the governor of South Carolina that he's going to do this. And he's very clear that this is going to be food and not men and not weapons. And it's that moment that leads eventually to South Carolina demanding Robert Anderson's surrender and then eventually firing upon him. And there's a way in which you can look at that and think that the Lincoln administration is very much doing that as a calculated measure to, make South Carolina the aggressor in that particular moment.
Well, as your book points out, although you describe it after your description of Fort Sumter, there were surrenders going on out west in Texas earlier.
Actually, most people think Fort Sumter is the first surrender. There actually are a number of surrenders that happened earlier in 1861, and one of the more interesting ones that people should probably know more about is the surrender of David Twiggs in San Antonio, which happens in February of that year.
So who is Twiggs?
Twiggs is a U.S. Army general. He commands the Department of Texas, which was in the pre-war army, one of the premier appointments. So he commands basically the frontier with Mexico and with Native Americans.
I, just, I can't remember ever hearing of Twiggs until I read your book.
Well,
Winfred Scott. He was the most
senior general in the U.S. Army.
And a distinguished, although aged out perhaps, a very senior, but he was Southern.
Yes. And well, so in some ways, he's like Robert Anderson. Robert Anderson and Twiggs are both Southern men. They're both from slaveholding families. They both had a very long military career fighting in the Mexican War and against Indian Wars. But one of the things that distinguished them is Twiggs has very open Southern sympathies during the secession crisis, and he actually asked Washington, the War Department, to relieve him of command. But before that happens, Confederate forces under McCulloch surround Twiggs's command, and here's the.
So just to picture it, he's sort of in the Alamo.
He's not sort of in the Alamo. He's in the Alamo, right? And famously, of course, they didn't surrender the Alamo in the Texas War of Independence. Then they fixed it up in the intervening decades, and Twiggs is in there, and he surrenders without firing a shot, and he becomes really the first villain of the Civil War for surrendering unnecessarily, for not meeting the threshold that's later going to be established, at Fort Sumter. And most people conclude that Twiggs and McCulloch had colluded to give Texas over to the Confederates. And we have some interesting eyewitnesses to McCulloch's or to Twiggs's surrender, rather. One is Robert Anderson's younger brother, Charles, who just happens to live in San Antonio, and he writes a letter to his brother, who at this point is under siege at Fort Sumter. One of the funny things about Fort Sumter, many people don't know, is they get regular mail delivery the entire time. Robert Anderson gets fan mail. He gets people writing letters saying, "Dear Major Anderson, I know you're very busy, but I'd like your autograph." And we know that he has his fan mail because he keeps it with him when he leaves the fort, and it's now in the Library of Congress. Anyway, his brother Charles writes in this letter telling him about Twiggs's surrender, and he warns him that Twiggs's surrender was treason pure and simple, in his words, and he warns him not to surrender under the same circumstances. And I think there's a way in which you can see through the honorable and dishonorable surrenders being played out there. Another interesting and relevant, I guess, eyewitness to Twiggs's surrender is Colonel Robert E. Lee, who at this point is still with the Union Army. He is stationed in Texas.
This is in February.
This is February of 1861.
The new president has not been installed.
This is still during the Buchanan administration, and Virginia has not left the Union yet. He's stationed in Texas, and he gets recalled to Washington.
He's a federal officer in the U.S. Army.
Yes. As like he had been for the previous 20 years.
With an assignment in Texas.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, his commanding officer, Twiggs, surrenders.
Yeah.
Has Lee been surrendered?
Well, that technically probably yes, but Lee is at this point sort of in transit. He just happens to arrive in San Antonio on the day that Twiggs surrenders because he had been stationed further west than that. And I think he was in civilian clothing, so I think he may not have been rounded. He wasn't rounded up with everybody else because he then makes his way to D.C. for reassignment, and we sort of know how that story goes.
I mean, this to me.
Yeah.
I mean, I know this is just a footnote to your book, but to me,
and so history is all about footnotes.
The idea, and as you describe in your book, there were a group of at least Southern sympathizers who almost take Lee into custody. I mean, and so you can imagine Robert E. Lee
as a Union prisoner
in Confederate hands.
Well, yeah, he breaks up. We don't have great details about his time there. We have some eyewitnesses who see him there and have some account of it, and we have a description of him breaking out in tears when he hears that Twiggs is surrendered and the conditions of it. And he also breaks out in tears at Appomattox Courthouse. So this. We don't tend to think of him as being a very emotional guy, but he.
You give this description not just of the tears, but about people. He's in a hotel. People overhear him probably praying.
Exactly. And he meets with Twiggs while he's there before he leaves, and we don't know what they talked about. That's one of those conversations that's sort of lost to us, because neither man talks about it, and Twiggs dies shortly thereafter. After this, he joins the Confederacy. He gets a Confederate command in Georgia, where he's from, but then dies in the middle of the war. So we never hear from him again. But
you mentioned that Anderson's viewed as a hero. And
yes.
How do the North react to Twiggs's surrender?
Oh, he gets labeled as really a traitor. They compare him to Benedict Arnold. There are calls for his execution. So he really is seen as being somebody who is betraying the trust that the government has placed in him with this enormously important command.
If he had done what Anderson did and just resisted until shots were fired at him and then surrendered, would he have been a little better off?
I think he would have been treated much better. I mean, part of it depends also on, you know, what he did subsequent to that. So the fact that he later took a Confederate command as a general, I think if he had—
Well, Robert E. Lee did that.
Yes, but Robert E. Lee— You know, also wasn't very well loved in the North for most of the war either. So, the idea, though, of having a military officer behaving honorably and not only officers but soldiers was phenomenally important in the 19th century in a way that I think we can't, you know, fully understand today. I mean, I think it's very foreign to us. I mean, one of the phenomenon, for instance, that I talk about in the book and that often baffle people when I talk about it, is in the midpoint of the war, they develop a prisoner exchange program between the Union and the Confederacy because both sides don't really want to hold on to prisoners of war. And it's called the Dix Hill Cartel. It's implemented in 1862. And it's a process by which prisoners of war are released under their promise not to fight again until they are told they are allowed to. And then eventually they have a process for exchanging prisoners after they've been paroled so then they're allowed to rejoin their regiment. But the idea of simply letting go enemy prisoners of war, letting go enemy soldiers that you have captured on the battlefield or captured as a process of a formal surrender and take it on their word that they're not going to fight again strikes many Americans today as just phenomenally odd. You can't imagine the United States letting the people in Guantanamo Bay go and say, promise not to fight again, because that's very foreign to our way of thinking about war and thinking about how one treats adversaries.
You make an important lesson about the Dix Hill and the ebb and flow of exchange policy. Mm. And let's take a break and then talk about that.
Sounds like a plan.
If you joined us late, I'm visiting with David Silganet. We're talking about his new book, Raising the White Flag, How Surrender Defined the American Civil War. And I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin, and my guest is David Silkenat. We've been talking about the Civil War, and particularly the concept and the application of those concepts about surrender in the war. David wanted me to be sure to tell you the title of the book is Raising the White Flag, and order it or go to your local bookstore and buy it. We're talking about prisoner exchanges and prisoner paroles and the expectation that a soldier might have if he surrenders on the battlefield. So talk about the concepts of surrendering on the battlefield as it developed and changed
yes.
in the American Civil War.
So when people think of Civil War prisons, if they ever think of Civil War prisons, they think about places like Andersonville or they think about Elmira
Salisbury.
Or Salisbury, right, to a more local example. But especially places like Andersonville that are opened late in the war, and they think about the sort of these enormous camps with tens of thousands of soldiers who are suffering and dying. And those definitely are an important facet of what life as a prisoner of war was like. But it's only from a very particular moment in the war, very late in the conflict. For most of the earlier phases of the war, especially after the Dix Hill Cartel that we talked about.
What time did that get the cartel.
So the cartel takes effect in September of 1862. There's some prisoner exchanges that happened before that, but
just
a big
sort of ad hoc exchange
exchanges that happened between generals, where they, after a battle, they would say, "You have 500 of my guys, I have 500 of your guys. Let's switch guys, though, because neither of us wants to hold on to these prisoners." But a big formal system established in 62. And one of the consequences of that is that it's very, because it was a very efficient system. You're released very quickly after you are captured, after you surrender, and very often you're exchanged very quickly. Is that's possible for soldiers to surrender multiple times in a very short period of time? There's a figure in the book, a man by the name of Alexander Hunter, who from Virginia, who fights in a number of battles, ends up in the 7 days as part of the defense of Richmond. His regiment gets overrun. He sort of hides in a ditch. He yells out when the Union troops approach, "Billy Yank, we surrender." He's taken prisoner. He's put in a prison in Boston Harbor, but he's only there for a couple weeks, and he says his treatment there was amazing. He describes the breakfast he has that has 7 or 8 dishes in it, and he says this is the best treatment prisoners of war have ever received. And he's in prison there when the Dixie Hill cartel takes effect, and he's able to then go back and join his regiment in time for 2nd Manassas. He participates in DeLee's march into Maryland. He's at Antietam. And at Antietam, he surrenders a second time when his regiment gets overrun again. They're a deeply undersized regiment. And then he is taken prisoner, is held for 2 days before he's paroled. He is paroled, and while he's paroled, before he's exchanged, he goes home to his family in Virginia, spends some time with them, and is eventually exchanged and rejoins his regiment at Fredericksburg in time for the defense of Fredericksburg. And so within 80 days, he surrenders twice, held prisoner twice, and exchanged twice. And I think that really speaks to the kind of fluid way in which surrender really shaped his experience during that part of the conflict. And so he's not, an emaciated soldier coming out of Andersonville. He actually emerges from prison, especially the first time, and in better shape than when he went in.
So if I'm in conflict on the battlefield and I'm got a choice between sort of fighting to the end or surrendering.
It seems like a very good choice,
very good
right?
Thing.
And the thing about surrendering on the battlefield, and in the book I talk about, there's roughly 700,000 people who surrender in the Civil War. About half of them do it as a part of big formal surrenders like Appomattox Courthouse or Vicksburg. And the other half are soldiers who are making this choice for themselves on the battlefield by, like Alexander Hunter, raising their hands and yelling, "I surrender." The people who surrender on the battlefield tend not to be the cowards on the battlefield. They're not the ones who are, afraid of combat. They actually tend to be the ones who are the bravest soldiers, the ones who are the closest to the enemy. In order to surrender effectively on a Civil War battlefield, you need to make eye contact with the person you're surrendering to. You need to be able to see them. They need to be able to see you against all
you
the smoke.
It's got to be a dramatic.
There's a lot of smoke and noise in a Civil War battlefield. The movies, I think, often make it seem like you can see lots of things, and you can't. These are very chaotic places. The powder produces a lot of smoke. The noise is phenomenal. It's deafening. So you actually have to be very close for this to happen. So the people who surrender on a battlefield tend to be soldiers who are the last to retreat when everyone else has run away, and they end up, very close to the enemy. And if they have fired their weapon, if you're familiar with sort of Civil War weaponry, if you fired your weapon, you're effectively unarmed at that point. And throwing down your weapon seems like the best option. And people like Alexander Hunter took that option on multiple occasions. He ends up actually surrendering a third time later in the war.
You mentioned one of the dramatic, I don't know what to call it, imaginative possibilities, is at Gettysburg.
Yeah.
And, we in North Carolina, we celebrate this sort of, we're the ones who led the attack.
Went
to the furthest. And you suggest that at that moment where the conflict is really intense, that there is, again, at that point in time, it was still possible that they could look forward to quick exchange.
Yeah, yeah. So that, I mean, that's very at the right end of the Dixiel cartel, right before it starts to collapse. And the, what I wanted to do in that chapter is we think of Gettysburg as this enormously bloody battle. There's you know, it's the bloodiest battle in all of North American history, you know, over 3 days. And often the way we, the stories we tell about Gettysburg are about the number of lives lost. But I wonder, what does that battle look like if you narrate it from the perspective of the men who find themselves in a position where surrender seems like the best choice? And what I found was the battle over all 3 days, in every single moment of the battle, people are throwing down their arms. And, you know, on the first day, there's a railroad cut where both Union and Confederate soldiers surrender in McPherson's Woods as the Union soldiers are retreating through town. In the second day, you've got surrenders at Little Round Top and in the Peach Orchard and in the wheat field. Obviously, on the third day, you've got Pickett's Charge. And we think of Pickett's Charge as this, you know, enormous Confederate charge up a hill in which lots of men lose their lives. But more Confederates surrender in Pickett's Charge than are killed, because they find themselves, you know, after they've fired their weapon, oftentimes in very close proximity to Union soldiers. And not only do Confederates surrender at Pickett's Charge, there are Union soldiers who surrender at Pickett's Charge and then have to march back down the hill with their Confederate captors. And, you know, for those many, I'm imagining many listeners have been to Gettysburg, you know, there's this stone wall there at the top of the ridge. And on one side of the stone wall, you would have had Confederate soldiers, and the other side, you've had Union soldiers. And, you know, if you're going to reload your weapon, you have to stand up. And if you stand up, you're going to be shot at. And I think you recognize then that sometimes yelling through the through the cracks in the wall, "I surrender," seems like a very good option, especially if you think, and many of the soldiers there did think, if I surrender now, I will be a prisoner for, you know, a few days at the most before I'm exchanged.
And otherwise, I'm going to be dead.
Exactly. You know, if those are your choices, those are good choices.
Well, well, take us this, so that you make it clear, and you don't have to tell us that, but if I think it's a choice between death and easy prison,
if I think
prison's going to be difficult or painful or it's just going to be worse than death, I'm going to keep on fighting.
Fighting, to be sure. And one of the things that happens basically at the same time that the Gettysburg happens is that this exchange system breaks down. And it basically breaks down because it breaks down for two reasons. One is both sides accuse the other side of cheating and exchanging more soldiers than they were entitled to. But the other more substantive reason is that the Union introduces African-American soldiers and Confederates.
We need to take a break.
Oh, sure.
But before we leave Gettysburg, the point that you made was that if the Southern soldiers who had reached the wall
yes.
and gone over it, if they had thought that being a prisoner would be worse than death, they would have kept on fighting. And you suggest if they had just fought a little harder, they might have
allowed themselves to be killed. Yes, I mean, and so the battle, we think of the battle as being so enormously bloody. It could have been that much bloodier. I mean, imagine,
but that they had a chance of overrunning, overrunning, and that if that had happened, then maybe Lee's dream of destroying the army of the Federals might have taken
that. There's that possibility.
Have people jumped you on this on your visit, on your book?
Not on that particular point yet, but maybe they haven't read far enough in the book. So,
if you joined us late, I'm visiting with David Silkenat. We're talking about his new book, Raising the White Flag, How Surrender Defined the American Civil War, and he and I'll be right back. Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Barton. My guest is David Silkenat. He is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh. He's a graduate of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill's Graduate School in History. And David, I've talked to some of your professors, and they are very proud of your work and have good memories of your days as a student here. We've been talking about your book, Raising the White Flag, How Surrender Defined the American Civil War. And what we're hearing is that this book, it forces a change on how we look at the Civil War. But what I'd like you to talk about is why, in your view, why is the book important? What are you trying to do?
Well, so I think The book, I think, tells us a few things that are really important about the Civil War. One is we tend to think of the Civil War as, you know, the bloodiest war in American history. The old figure is 620,000 dead. The new figure is something in the order of 750,000 dead. But the Civil War could have been much bloodier. If we imagine all the men who surrendered in the war, some 700,000 men, if they had been compelled to fight to the death, the kind of death toll would be astronomically different. You know, we think about Vicksburg. What would have happened if Grant's forces at Vicksburg had been forced to assault the city? How many of his men would have died? How many Confederates would have died? How many civilians would have died? You know, and we sort of amplify that through all the surrenders that happened in the war. It could have been a war of a whole other magnitude of brutality. And I guess the second big observation I'd like to make is that, you know, surrender really does shape the ways in which the war ends. That the Lincoln administration in the final months of the war concludes that they want the war to end as quickly as they can. That they want to end the bloodshed as quickly as they can. The 1864 is the bloodiest year of the war, and Lincoln sees surrender as a way of enticing Confederates to lay down their arms and to bring some healing and closure. And he tells his generals to offer as generous terms as they can. And he says, like, let the Confederates lay down their arms, let them go home. And when Grant meets with Lee in the McLean parlor in Appomattox Courthouse, he gives them extraordinarily generous terms. The men are immediately going to be paroled. They're going to be given rations. You know, they're not going to go to prison. They're not going to be prosecuted for treason or other kinds of crimes. They're not going to be harassed by the government for their conduct during the war. And Lee's entire army is able to go home, and Lee himself is able to go
home. He's paroled. And
he leaves before most of his army has been paroled. He takes Traveler and rides off into the sunset or something. I guess he's riding east, so he's riding into the sunrise. And when news of Lee's surrender reaches other Confederate armies, and there's a number of obviously Confederate armies that are still in the field at that point, there's not much more they can ask for in terms of, you know, creating generous terms of surrender. And so part of the reason why, in some ways, the Civil War ends the way that it does, it could have ended with, you know, a bloodbath. It could have ended with a series of battles at Appomattox Courthouse and Bennett Place and other sites further west than that. But the fact that it doesn't, I think, is really important in thinking about how the war ends. And the ways in which that then shapes, you know, the post-war world, that Confederates, there's not a period of internal crises as you put all the Confederate leadership on trial. You know, for instance, you know, they hold a couple of the high Confederate political leaders in prison briefly. But beyond that, you know, there aren't executions of General Lee on down. And you can think of other civil wars in human history where those kinds of – where the war ends and the losing side pays an enormous cost. And Lincoln makes the decision not to do that and to use surrender as a way of bringing the war to a close. And I think that's an important way to think about how this war ends and what it means.
Well, will you describe one of the part of that was that the Lincoln administration mm-hmm. seemed to be focused on reconciliation between the two geographical entities
sure.
and the peoples rather than on imposing the idea of a restructuring of race relations and all of that, and that the that they were successful.
Well,
in this policy
they're bringing
the.
I mean, obviously, the Lincoln administration's whole war policy is complicated, of course, by Lincoln's assassination, and that shapes Bennett Place and the subsequent events. But it's clear by, you know, 1865 that slavery as an institution is dead, right, and that. It's dead not only because of the Emancipation Proclamation and because of the passage of the 13th Amendment through Congress, but also on a practical level, slavery has been destroyed by the war, partially due to the actions of Union armies and partially due to the actions of enslaved people themselves who run away by the hundreds of thousands and create freedom for themselves. And so you know, he's making a choice there about at least how to stop the bloodshed at that particular moment. You know, if we think about Grant, for instance, and Grant often gets, you know, a reputation as being a butcher. Grant's involved in three big surrenders in the war at Fort Donelson, at Vicksburg, and
you got to come back to talk about those because there's very important parts that we've missed.
And so you know, when he comes to talk to Lee, he's an expert about how surrender works. In fact, lots of people, you know, these are not neophytes, and you know, Grant, even though he was a great warrior in many ways, if you know, you can say that kind of thing, he tried very hard when he could to avoid.
To be
causing unnecessary death, and you know, the fact that he was able to orchestrate those three surrenders, you know, I think speaks to that. You can imagine each of those playing out very differently by a general who was unwilling to accept the surrender of a foe and forcing that final battle.
There's so much more to talk about, so much more in your wonderful new book, and I hope that when you're back from Scotland again, maybe we can...
Chapel Hill will always bring me back here, so I'm always happy to be here.
Our guest has been David Silkenet. His book, Raising the White Flag, How Surrender Defined the American Civil War, is hot off the presses and doing well.
Yes.
Thanks, David.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to all y'all for listening. This is D.G. Martin and Who's Talking, and I'll be back here before you know it.